In 1994, we were invited by the University of the Negev in Israel to take part in an international gathering whose purpose was to celebrate, I think, the university's coming of age. I was to read a paper on aspects of the novel, or the novel today, one of those comfortably vague prospectuses which make few demands on either speaker or audience. Iris asked not to give a paper, but said she would rather take part in a discussion, in which she would answer questions on her novels or philosophical writings. She had often done this before, and it was always a success, because while never holding the floor, she had the knack of taking seriously anything that was put forward by a questioner and investigating its potential in a friendly and sympathetic way, which was both flattering and rewarding for the audience. This time, it all went wrong. The chairman was sympathetic, but soon baffled and made uncomfortable by Iris's inability to bring out the words she seemed to want. Her delivery had always been slow and thoughtful and a little hesitant, and at first I was not perturbed, sure that she would recover in a few minutes as she got the feel of the gathering. It was hard to say how conscious she was of her own difficulty, but the effect soon became paralyzing, for the listener as well as for herself. The audience was polite, but the liveliness and curiosity in their faces was gone. They began to look concerned and embarrassed. Israelis are straightforward in their reactions. Several people simply got up and left the conference room. I thought she would tell me afterwards how awful it had been, and that for some reason she simply hadn't felt up to it. But that did not happen. She seemed unaware, and to shrug the incident off, together with my cautious solicitude. I tried to avoid giving any impression that a fiasco had taken place. The chairman and one or two others came up to her afterwards, and she talked to them and laughed in her natural way. One asked about her last novel, The Green Knight, and produced a copy for her to sign. It was at that moment I remembered being surprised at her telling me, several months before, that she was in trouble over her current novel, the one that appeared the following year as Jackson's Dilemma. Once before, if I asked her, or sometimes if I didn't, she would complain she was stuck. She couldn't get on with the current novel, and in any case it was no good at all. I used to make reassuring noises, knowing this would pass, and that in a few days she would suddenly seize pencil and paper while we sat eating or drinking at the kitchen table and write something down. I would say, "Better?" And she would reply, "I think so." But this time it was quite different. "It's this man Jackson," she has said to me one day with a sort of worried detachment. "I can't make out who he is or what he's doing." I was interested because she hardly ever spoke of the people in a novel she was writing. "Perhaps he'll turn out to be a woman," I said. Iris was always indulgent to a joke from me, even a feeble one, but now she looked serious, even solemn and puzzled. "I don't think he's been born yet," she said. The mysteriousness of Iris's remark seemed to me at the time quite normal. "Don't worry. I expect he'll be born any day now," I said absently. But she continued to look worried and upset. "I shan't do it, and she'll never do another," she said, still in that quiet, detached tone. She'd often said such things before, though not quite like that. I had known before the mood would pass, and this one, though much odder, would too. I could not imagine anything else. But suddenly, standing blinking in the dry, dusty sunlight at the Negev, I realized for the first time that something might be seriously wrong. I realized it, but without any feeling of alarm, because I was somehow sure that everything would carry on just as usual. In a sense, I was right. When the Alzheimer patient loses touch with time, time seems to lose both its prospective and its retrospective significance. For the partner, that is. Knowing that Iris would always be the same, I felt that the tiny, disturbing eccentricity I'd noticed then, when we talked about Jackson, must always have been present and would go on, undisturbed, into the future. Nothing that Iris could do, and nothing that could happen to her, could possibly make her any different. The eeriness of Alzheimer's beginnings is also its reassurance. Part of me knew that I ought to be seriously worried about the future. Part knew that neither future nor past was of any consequence. Jackson had been finished at last and named Jackson's Dilemma. Iris was gloomy about it, but so she was about any novel she had done with, and I did not feel unduly perturbed. For the first time, I took to inquiring about her ideas for a next novel. She had ideas, she said, but they wouldn't come together. She was trying to catch something by its tail, and it always eluded her. She sounded resigned. Hoping against hope now, I worried and importuned her every day. Any luck? Is anything happening? You must go on trying. If I went on too long, she would start crying, and then I stopped quickly and tried to console her. After a Far Eastern trip, the sardonic face of Somerset Maugham, smiling from signed photos all round the hotel room, still haunted me at moments when I was telling Iris that all writers at some time suffered from writer's block. "I never had writer's block," he seemed to be saying, with an air of contempt. Nor did Iris have it. That soon became clear. Alzheimer's is, in fact, like an insidious fog, barely noticeable until everything around has disappeared. After that, it is no longer possible to believe that a world outside the fog exists. First, we saw our own friendly Harris GP, who asked Iris who the Prime Minister was. She had no idea, but said to him with a smile that it surely didn't matter. He arranged an appointment at the big hospital with a specialist in geriatrics. Brain scans followed, and after an article appeared about this famous novelist's current difficulties, the Cambridge Research Unit of the Medical Council took a special interest, giving her a number of exhaustive tests in memory and language, which she underwent politely, seeming both to humour the researchers and to enjoy working with them. Jackson's Dilemma came out and got exceptionally good reviews. I read these reviews to Iris, a thing I had never done before, because she'd never before wanted to listen. Now she listened politely, but without understanding. The irony did not bother her or even occur to her. Nor did I tell her that there'd also been a number of letters about the reviews, pointing out small errors and inconsistencies in the narrative of Jackson's Dilemma. It was clear that these points were mostly made by fans, fondly indicating that the writer they admired so much could sometimes nod. Meanwhile, I was anxiously canvassing medical opinion about the possibility of ameliorative drugs. An old friend and fan, a Swedish expert on autism, sent some pills to try. The new experimental drugs were not recommended, and no doubt wisely, for they have since been shown to be all too temporary in their effect, and apt, during a brief period of possible effectiveness, to confuse and even horrify the recipient. The friendly fog suddenly disperses, revealing a precipice before the feet. When writing about the onset of Alzheimer's, it is difficult to remember a sequence of events, what happened when, in what order. The condition seems to get into the narrative, producing repetition and preoccupied query, miming its own state. I remarked on this to Peter Conradi, Iris's future biographer, who had already become a pillar of close friendship, support and encouragement. He and his friend and partner, Jim O'Neill, were long-standing friends of Iris's, who had in former times often visited them in Clapham. Peter is a passionate admirer of her books and knows them inside out. Even more important, he loves her and the atmosphere in which she lives and moves. He knows her thought, and he responds to her own knowledge with deep feeling. The same goes for Jim, whose sense of Iris's being gives her a unique kind of comfort. He too is widely read in her novels and a shrewd and practical critic. I do not think Iris would ever have taken up meditation, as done in their own way by Peter and Jim. Her sense of things worked differently, and in its own way. But she had once fell in love, and that was some years ago now, with their Welsh sheepdog, Cloudy, a beautiful animal with a grey and white coat and blue eyes. It appears in her penultimate novel, The Green Knight, as the dog Anax. Iris loved talking to this extraordinarily dedicated and relaxing couple about books and philosophy and Buddhism. Both somehow fit a routine of meditation, retreats, hospitality to visiting dignitaries from Tibet to Bhutan into their own working lives, Jim a psychotherapist, Peter a professor of literature. In now distant days, Iris used to return to Steeple Aston or Hartley Road, full of her visit to them and of what they told her about their Welsh cottage, a converted schoolhouse. They told her of the pool they'd built in the field beneath it, the kingfishers and otters who came to visit there. They were always pressing us to come and stay. When we managed it at last, Iris already needed all the support this great pair could give her. Jackson came out in 1995. Iris's condition has deteriorated steadily since then. Like someone who knows he cannot for much longer avoid going out into the cold, I still shrink from the need for professional care. All that is to come, but let us postpone it while we can. Iris becomes troubled if she feels a visit is to keep her company or to look after her if I have to be absent. In fact, I am never absent. So helpers are not now needed. We are lucky to be able to go on living in the state to which we have always been accustomed. And Peter and Jim make all this still easier. They do not bother about the dirt in the carpet or the stains on the glasses, although their own home is kept like a new pin, and so is the Welsh cottage. They pick us up as often as it can be done and carry us off there. When life fails, what's the good of going to Wales? We proclaim Auden's lines joyously together sometimes, sitting in the back of the car. It's a joke, for we know better. So it seems does Cloudy, who sleeps during the journey with her head in Iris's lap, but who opens her muzzle to smile, while her blue eyes shine with anticipation.